somebody.
It was such a crowded room, I thought I had a city hall or something. So I walked in, walked out. But no, it is the right place, isn't it? Yes. And everyone here bright and early chomping away, which is quite useful. So, just a minute. Now we've got a short window here this morning, very short window. And I'm so glad we did get your apology yesterday, Honourable Pinguini. The flight and one thing and another. I hope it wasn't anything to do with the debt we were paying. And then we also got your apology, but it was a bit garbled, so I'm sure that was fixed up, wasn't it? Right. Apologies, etc., etc. You can see what we've just quickly got to get through is a few decisions. We haven't had a quorum to take a decision for some time. Is that correct? So, on that note, is there any other business? We have to finish at 10:30. I am appealing to the members going to another committee to wait until about 9:05 at the very least to get through the decision. All right. I'm just looking at you. I know you're the core group in Labour. So, can we have someone to propose the adoption? Yes, right, Honourable Williams and Tiako. And the apologies remain different. It's medical apologies from Buyani and bereavement, compassionate leave, Montash, and who else?
Chair, do you receive any other apologies?
Yes. Will you please tell the Honourable Albert he represents the minority parties here? I'd like to see him physically here. All right. On that note, committee business. Minister. Yes, Honourable Williams.
Chairperson, the member from the IMP has just had to go to.
Right, he must have heard you. Yes, Mr. Hazen, we got the apology yesterday, and thank you for being here today. Right, the minutes. Members, you're looking at the 22nd of August, right? And there are three sets attached. So start off with the first couple of pages. Does everyone have a copy? Right. Page one. Look at who's there and who isn't there in the spelling of your name. Then please look at page 222.
Page one.
Yeah, that was page one, but now 222.
Yeah.
No, my name. Oh, right. What? They've misspelled your name. Let me just see that. No, Honourable Tiako, let's not debate your initials, but it's quite clear. It's L-T, Lorato.
Lorato.
Well, there we are. Can you spell my name and pronounce mine, Jomahi? Right. So, just on that note then, please check on that. And I'm surprised, this is supposed to be on permanent things. Don't look at me oddly. I mean, I'm surprised you can't get a name right. Second page, attendance. Right, opening and welcome. Adoption of agenda. Now, I wasn't absent. I had an apology. What kind of apology was? Think very clearly. Exactly, I was sitting in ICU.
Yes.
So please note that, I wasn't just absent. No, it does.
Yes.
It says, right, Mrs. J being absent.
Yes.
Yes.
Everybody can be used to whether it's... Yes, that's right. You are saying you were in ICU, so we should also indicate in Buyana that Buyana had an accident.
No, what you need to know is an apology. There's a difference with being absent and an apology. People are absent without an apology. Unfortunately, that's how Parliament works and the tax man. All right? Let's keep it simple. May I have someone to propose the adoption? Please correct the initials of the Honourable Tierko. Can we have somebody who was there to... Yes, Honourable Linguini, Honourable Tierko. Right. Next set of minutes will be the... Check your spellings and everything else. 24th August. And that was a lot of people present there. You must have still been on the chair at that time, I think, were you? Or Tierko, right. So you've got adoption, you've got that, right, page 2. Let me just check here, why are your initials right here? Don't understand. Right. That was page 2. Page 3. Can somebody who was present propose adoption? Honourable Williams. Honourable Van Skulfbeck. Right. Then we go to page 12. That is the minutes of the 12th of September, rather. That is page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Check the spellings and everything else. All right? Has that been checked through, please? All right. Someone to propose adoption. Honourable Tierko. Seconded by the Honourable Kitalia. Right. Okay. For those who still who are here, and you are caring for the day, including myself, please note when the apologies are medical, compassionate leave, or absent. It tells you there at the top. All right, under on the register. Okay, but that's what it goes to the files. On that note, thank you very much. Minutes done, at least 3 sets. And then we go down to the terms of reference. You will recall that when we... I had our last meeting and adjourned until this time. We were working on the localization of procurement. You remember, I think Transnet were present at the time. Am I right? Was only Transnet at the time? Right. And Prasa were present, right. And we were not, the committee as a whole expressed their concern. In fact, it was a very serious concern expressed by initially yourself, Honourable Williams, and also noted very clearly the Honourable MacPherson, and the committee equally agreed, those of you who were present at the time. But as I pointed out, we needed to take that position to this meeting because we never had a quorum to take a decision for. And I think that must be very clear. So we asked for a framework of terms of reference, and we've got the staff here who produced something. Now, when I look at this, terms of reference, inquiry into compliance, etc., etc., it says a rail sector case study. Now, the thing is this, when we went on that oversight as such, was it simply the rail sector? It wasn't, you see. Now, I'm just getting, this is from yourself. I see Honourable William shaking his head, yourself, Honourable MacPherson. Remember, it was broader than that.
Yeah.
So we can't simply say the rail case sector study. Are we agreed?
Yes.
Yes. But if we look at this framework, is that what we're agreeing on? The background? The purpose of the inquiry? Why are we doing this? We don't normally do this. So why? What is the objective here? And the objective is what? It really is to ensure that the policies on the table, such as this localization, etc., beneficiation, local public procurement, are effective. quickly implemented because the purpose is job creation and growing the economy. Isn't that correct? Do we all agree?
Mm-hmm.
So I hope you're noting then that Ms. Sheldon, I think, worked with others on this, the content being the scope. Looking at the designated sectors, and this is a question that came to mind, who actually designates? The minister requests that certain, Minister of Trade and Industry, that certain sectors are designated. But who has the power to do this? Well, come on, honourable members, it's finance. We've been working on this for some time now. The National Treasury. You'll see they'll give us a list. The minister's requested this and it's been done. And they'll designate. We get that list every quarter or twice a year. So it may be that we may have to bring them in as well. I'm not suggesting joint committees and the like, but at least have them involved. The others involved here would be others in the, it could be EDD, for example. It could be, public enterprises. It could be a number of others whom we would work with in the same manner we did with the steel industry. All right? But at this time of year, it's very difficult, and early next year, to be talking of running a whole lot of joint committees. We're not going to have that luxury. All right, so then it says paper trails of sample transactions. I mean, we're not looking at the Hansel and Gretel issue, but paper trail. Yeah, Ms. Sheldon, perhaps just explain how you envisage this trail.
Based on, because it wasn't at the meeting we indicated, so based on what discussions with my colleagues and yourself, my understanding is that we want some evidence-based inquiry. So it's not just about sitting with them and talking to them and also having some kind of paper-based evidence that actually these transactions did happen and who it was with, what was procured, that type of thing.
Mr. Hermans, are you looking at the rule book? And what are you looking at that's really?
Do you looking at the functions of the portfolio committee and what the portfolio committee can do?
Next number?
Rule 227, 1C, and may monitor, investigate, inquire into, and make recommendations concerning any such executive organ of state, constitutional institution, or other body of institution, including the legislative program, budget, rationalization, restructuring, functioning, organizational structure, staff, and policies of such organ of state, institution, or other body or institution. You may consult in the areas of executive organs of state or constitutional institution, and must perform any other functions, duties, as captured in the program.
So indeed, we have every authority to do this. On top of it, if we find anyone being recalcitrant, then for the first time, this committee will exercise its authority of issuing a summons. But I always believe we should approach people from a persuasive route first, and then, you know, after all, you don't want to exhaust your major arsenal first. You just start off requesting, but we don't quest and request. We're going to request once. If people don't pitch, we will summon. Unless, of course, they're in hospital or out of the country. All right? So we'll rely on staff to ensure that they can get mutual dates. All right, so that's all right in the paper trail. We now know what that is. We're wanting evidence, not talking. We don't want any more talk shows. I mean, that's what annoyed you, wasn't it, Honourable McPherson? You said you've got enough paper here. Right, planned activities. Hearings with Transnet, PRASA, OEMs, government departments, etc. And basically any other relevant entity. You see, we don't want to just put the PRASA and Transnet down, but any other relevant entity. Research on compliance. The only thing that worries me when I hear the word research, it means 2 years down the line. I want this word research kept in its pristine understanding and not an excuse for delay. Right? Site visits. That's if we have the time. Broad time frames for these activities. The first thing we've got to be realistic about, you see, we're in October. In fact, someone told me we're basically in the middle of October next week. So when do we intend finishing this? Over Christmas or what? Let's be realistic. We'll start now, get the time frames done, get these invitations out, get all this other, start the research and so on, get it together, and perhaps, I'm using the word perhaps, have our first meeting this year, at least as a, perhaps getting everyone in and saying, this is where we're going. You've got the whole Christmas season, instead of going on holiday to prepare, and then we come back in the new year. Do you like that idea?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Are we agreed? So we have the first general meeting with the Hermans with everyone involved. The 1st December is the last day. I think we've got to look closer to November.
Yeah.
Yes, Honourable Max. You've been very quiet.
Yeah, well, maybe a bit of jet lag. Can I speak to this document?
On that issue, because we haven't got the resources.
Oh, no, I'm going to get to the resources. I'll wait for you then.
Then we go to the resources, access to X and Y and Z, and legal advisor. Now this is a big issue. A legal advisor. Now why do we need a legal advisor? Not to tell us about our policy. But we're not contract lawyers. Let's get that straight. We're not a contract. So we've got to get something there, all right? And now that requires Mr. Herman immediately start a process to apply for this resource. It involves financial resources. Ask, why can't we use Parliament? We just don't have sufficient legal advisors in Parliament doing this at the moment. Access to relevant procurement documentation. Well, of course we've got automatic access since when is something denied Parliament, unless it's sitting in the judiciary waiting for a decision. Isn't that correct, Ms. Alexander Murphy? I mean, what can be denied Parliament?
Chair, I understand it's not according to the rules, Parliament can request documents.
I mean, we must start exercising this authority and not cry at the end of 5 years. Right, industry, technical manual, with understanding of the value chain. We think we understand it, we don't. So we may need an industry person with a clear understanding here. But you know, members, you're all members here. You may have the names of people and say, X is very good. So do that. Buy in support from SCOF. That Scopa is a CEO. A standing committee on finance. Scopa is the other person. PC on public enterprises. Okay, buy-in. We're talking about buy-in and not a joint committee in order to just work with them. They get invited. They can come to any meeting, etc. Can we leave it in that flexible framework? Right. Now, I'm finished and I need... Yeah, go ahead, Honourable MacPherson.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair.
And welcome back.
Thank you. I'm sure you're very glad to have me back. I just want to say, this was something that we wrote to you in July about. And so we certainly at the DO are really pleased and grateful that this issue has been taken seriously. And we know that the committee is united in wanting to get to the bottom of this. I think it would be critical to ensure that we have the requisite legal assistance to allow us to plow through these contracts because they are hugely complicated. There are a number of companies that these contracts deal with, and I suspect there's going to be a lot of pushback from those people that don't want to get to the bottom of this. But it's also really important that we have and we actually are able to submit a list to this committee of people that we want to appear before this inquiry. I I would ask that we be given the opportunity that members can submit lists of people that we want to appear before the inquiry, whether they are in fact trans executives, for example, or whether they are in fact intermediaries that work between Transnet and the companies that receive these contracts. I think it'd be critical that we bring those people before this committee and that we get to the bottom of that. So I would propose that flowing from this, that members are given an opportunity to submit to yourself a list of entities, private companies, intermediaries, individuals that you would want to call before this inquiry to give testimony.
Well, certainly, you know, Honourable Members, and we've always done that. If you look, remember over the steel and look how effective we were as a result of that. Honourable Kessler?
I'm not disputing what Honourable McPherson is saying. I'm saying is that that list, we're going to consider all the lists on when we're going to come as a committee and select.
Well, what we've done in the past, which has proved very effective, members in the committee have submitted these things. And, you know, I can't just say I want X and we must motivate, we must reason. You know, you can't just have someone because that's a private family matter or something. No, we need to be reasonable and rational. And so we would bring this here to a committee, as we're doing this morning, and say, look, we've got a C here from the DA, a couple of people, one, you know, on this list, from the ANC, from the EFF, you know, from the IFP, you see. And then as a committee, we say, right, we've got this amount of time, we've got these three people are all doing this on the same thing. How do we approach it? But the important thing we must agree on, the only way we succeeded with steel is we stood as one. We don't succeed when this party goes this way, another, and someone in the middle. We've got to stand together and say this is what we want to achieve. So is this person going to actually add value, particularly when we're not getting a response from the number one, in inverted commas? By that, I'm talking of Transnet, no one else. And so, you know, in there we may not get what we want from, say, Mr. Garma, for example. So we may then say, yeah, but Chair, X, who was intervening here and doing this, has got the information. Can we invite that person? Do you understand? So that's what we want to achieve. But this is a committee here, and we're working in that particular matter. Can we agree on that, Honourable Member? Right. And of course, I couldn't agree more about the legal advisor. Oh, sorry, Honourable Linguini.
No, thank you. From my side, Chair, I don't dispute or against any of the proposals on the table regarding the list and so forth. But for EFF, I'll have to go and consult first on possible people that we want to bring.
Exactly.
Because I know we have, as the EFF, have opened a criminal case against Transnet as well. So you will want to check that against each other, how is it going to implicate our case that we've opened against Transnet and the possible people that we will want to bring. So I'll have to go and consult first and then give you my name on a later stage.
No, of course, we must also be practical and reasonable about this. No one's here with their own jacket. Honourable, yes, Honourable, yes, sir. I didn't quite hear you.
Okay, thank you. I was actually...
Now, I don't want to be privy to private conversations. Right, Honourable McPherson, let me just put this more formally now. You're proposing something, I agreed, I said, no problem with Chair. So the proposal on the table is that, yes, if you like, as parties, we all go through our parties, obviously. Let's see who we bring to the table here. Do we agree on that proposal, Honourable Kierke?
Sure,
you agree. Now, can we have a seconder? No, you can't second your own proposal.
But I can put that in.
No, you've proposed it. Seconder. Now, what we need thereafter is, are there any objections? I didn't think there were, but... No, okay. So there we are, and I don't think there's no other, everyone's very pleased. No objections to the framework. How soon will it take you to flesh this out, Ms. Sheldon?
Chair as well. So you are released as and when you can.
but we hope you can stay here until 9:30. No, I'm saying we hope. That's all. Hope. Right. Can we then move into yourself, Advocate Van der Merwe? You're going to brief us on this framework draft bill. If when you do leave, perhaps to do so quietly and allow others to move up. We really just want the key issues because we're spending the whole of tomorrow, or certainly 2 hours. Am I right? Of tomorrow? No, 10 hours. Yes, I forgot 10 hours. From 9 o'clock to 6 o'clock. No, well, I mean, depends how we go, doesn't it? Depends exactly how we go. You've got the day off on Friday. 9 to 5, 9 to 10. Yeah, no, we need to do, this is a committee bill. Let us show our enthusiasm, but I'm not going to delay your flight. Let me do that. We have here got a whip collie star with a huge sort of saddle whip.
Who receives either no income or
the amount that I put in the bill is less than 3,500 rand per month. But you will see in the purple bit on the slide, there are other options. For instance, Treasury is of the view that debt review only becomes viable if you earn more than 10,000 rand. Debt Busters gave also some statistics when the committee was consulting. They have indicated 7,500 rand as the cutoff. So that is still a decision that this committee will have to consider. What is the maximum income that we are going to look at here? This person must also have no realizable assets, and I'll talk about that just now, and must be over-indebted. So if you earn 3,500 rand, if that is the cutoff, but you are responsible, if you can afford to pay your debt, then you will not qualify. It must be someone who is over-indebted, because that is the purpose of this measure. What is a realizable asset? In other words, persons who have realizable assets will not qualify. And what would those be? It would be something that can quickly be converted into cash at a value that reasonably reflects the second-hand market value of that asset. But it does not include. So if you have tools of trade and you earn less than the income that we determine, you will still qualify. Household furniture. Now, like I said, I looked at the no income, no assets programs of other countries. The circumstances are different from ours. So this is definitely something that the committee will still have to consider, because, for instance, they include a motor vehicle. If that is something that we want to include, there is precedent for it, but is that suitable for South African circumstances? I am not sure. We will have to discuss that as a committee. But I have excluded a pension fund. So I know that there was a concern about teachers quitting their jobs so they can use their pension fund to pay. So the pension fund will not disqualify you from this measure. The fact that there's going to be a future payment of a retirement annuity or a pension fund or something, that will not be regarded as a reliable asset. Then the type of debt, okay, and I'll go a little bit faster, I think. There must be a cut-off date. That is what this committee decided. I have given three possible dates there. The date when this committee received permission to do the bill might be a little bit too long ago. It's 2016, but it might be the appropriate date. Might be the date on which we publish this bill. Might be the date when the bill becomes operational. There's a risk the later, of course, we go into the date with people having incurred debt in the hope that they will get this measure. But again, that is something for this committee to consider. The maximum amount of debt, in other words, there might also be a cap on debt. If you owe a million rand, then you will not qualify for this measure. There must be something else that will assist you, but it will not be this measure. I could not really find statistics. I think to recall that there was a proposal for about 50,000 rand maximum. That could actually be justified. I'll talk about the type of debt now. When we look at small debts or small credit agreements, I could not find other statistics. I know Debt Busters gave 160,000 as average for debt review debt. You know, the total amount for people under debt review, but that includes vehicles and mortgages. So clearly, that is outside of the scope here. And of course, it must be unsecured debt. So this is now where I'm talking about the type of debt and where we can maybe look at the 50,000. I've currently included small and intermediate credit agreements. That can still be discussed. But perhaps the small credit agreement, which says that your facility limit is up to 15,000. So a good argument could be to say, well, we can accept two of these type of agreements, which brings us to 30,000, or maybe smaller amounts, but definitely not more than that. So there is at least something that we can tie the amount of 30,000 to, but I think that is something that the committee will still have to discuss and consider. The kind of debt that will not be included is pawn transactions, mortgages, and credit guarantees. Those are in different categories. But I have made specific provision for Section 10 developmental credit agreements. These are credit agreements that are, like the name says, they are developmental in nature. Educational loans, low-income housing, socio-economic development. The one thing that makes them different is that your recklessness criteria does not apply to these loans. So if a person applies for a Section 10 developmental credit agreement, affordability assessment does not have to be done. So that is a big difference. There is also another type of credit agreement, and it came up during the discussion, Section 11, public interest credit agreement. But I understand from the National Credit Regulator that there isn't currently any such agreements in place, because they happen when there, for instance, is a natural disaster. Then the minister can make, either by a proclamation in the Gazette or another, or by regulation, make certain provisions for public interest loans. And to them also, the lending provisions do not apply. So that is another one, but because there is currently nothing of that sort in play, I did not include them in the bill. Now, the other thing is, if we look at, we know that this will have to be an application process for the purposes of transparency, but what if there are other processes in play? So the other processes that I look at is if there's court proceedings and if there's debt review proceedings already underway. If there's court proceedings underway, the draft is proposing that that consumer will not be allowed to apply for debt relief. The reason simply being, do not interfere with the court process. But I have not left that person at the mercy of the credit provider either, because I'm proposing an amendment to say that the court can actually take judicial notice of this person's circumstances, and if the circumstances qualify for that criteria, with a person is the maximum income, maximum debt, etc., the court can then say that this is a candidate for debt relief, and then the court can refer that person to the National Credit Regulator. So the court will be the party that interferes with the court proceedings and not the consumer. Debt review, there is a bit of a risk. We are saying that we are targeting people who are in the gap, you know, who can't really afford debt review and so on. But I have in the bill made provision that someone who is subject to a debt review process can apply for debt relief. My thinking was, a person who's under debt review circumstances might really deteriorate significantly to such an extent that person actually does become a candidate for debt relief. If the person still qualifies for debt review, you will see from the process, the National Credit Regulator must consider debt review and might even impact refer the person back and say, no, you are a better candidate for debt review, and we would rather have you there. But still, as I say, draft bill, committee can say no. If you are under debt review, that must rather terminate, and then you can, you know, those are all possible things. The process. A person will submit an application, the consumer, if that consumer thinks that the consumer qualifies. The National Credit Regulator, and I'm using the National Credit Regulator as the body, simply because they are in existence. It is for this committee to decide. The department will have to be consulted because they will have to be the body that executes. But it could be another body that is appointed to do this. I'm simply using Credit Regulator. During a subcommittee, the Credit Regulator has indicated that they would be okay with it, and I'm supported like that, to receive these applications. You'll see on the last slide, I do suggest that there should be further consultation with the National Credit Regulator and the Tribunal so that this committee can be satisfied that there is capacity and what needs to be done to make sure that there is capacity if there isn't. But so when I use Regulator or Tribunal, it is in that spirit. Existing bodies, implementation is simply much more practical because there are in existence, there's nothing new that has been set up first, but yes, there might be a change to that. So keep that in mind when I use those two terms. So the regulator will provide proof of the receipt of the application to the consumer. Why? So the consumer, when a credit provider comes with a summons or a letter of demand, can show the proof and say, I am currently an applicant for debt relief. And then the credit provider, if he did not know about the application, knows that he needs to stop because there are certain requirements. But how do we make the credit provider aware of it? The National Credit Regulator must also notify affected credit providers and every registered credit bureau of the receipt of an application. We can change that. We can say it must be published in the Government Gazette. That is still something that we can think about. I think the regulator must maybe also give some input there to the committee. What would be the best way, capacity-wise, resource-wise, to do that. Then, because this application, I'm trying to get a process where once this reached the tribunal, I do not want the tribunal to be sitting on 4 or 5 day trials when considering one application. Or even on a 1 day trial, the tribunal should be able to consider 50, 60 applications in a day and finish it off. And the only way for that to happen is if the tribunal considers on paper alone. This is the kind of process that you have in motion court, in both the magistrate court and the high court. Things happen on application, it's only on paper. The problem with this is that it must not be a dispute. Now, the application and the criteria is kind of a tick box exercise. Either the consumer is going to qualify or not. But we must still give an ear to the credit provider. And how I've done that is to say that the credit provider may submit an affidavit that will state any fact that will disqualify the consumer. In other words, no, this person 30 days ago applied for credit with this company, and he gave me this payslip that shows he earned 20,000 rand. So that would be a significant fact for the regulator to take into account. But also an affidavit to speak to the types of orders that the tribunal may make. And what I had in mind here is it might be a retail company that has provided certain loans, a very small base, and the retail company might say to the tribunal, look, I understand that you can suspend or extinguish, but if you extinguish all these type of consumers, the credit agreement for these consumers, you are going to bankrupt me, and I will not be able to function. So just to put those facts before the tribunal, when the tribunal makes a decision, that the credit provider has an opportunity to be heard. There was a concern yesterday that we don't want the credit provider to be able to stop the process. So I will already have made a note to add that this affidavit that can be submitted must be done within a certain time from the publication or the notification of the credit provider by the regulator. So then, once this is now done, the regulator then considers the application. If there's reckless lending, if there's unlawful lending, those the regulator then can refer to the tribunal for an order to declare those credit agreements void. If there's secure debts, to exclude that. If the person does not qualify, the National Credit Regulator can either reject and then not make provision for it to be like a process of non-referral so that someone can take that directly to the tribunal on review. But the credit regulator might also say, no, you're a better candidate for debt review, and then refer to school for debt review so that we still make use of the current remedies that this Act provides and not just straight go into debt relief. If the person qualifies, then the credit regulator refers to the tribunal for an order related to want of debt relief. Now, even in the tribunal, there must then still be a consideration of all the facts, of all the possible remedies. I have provided in the bill for the tribunal to be able to hear these matters with a single member so that we can get this process fast as possible. And like I say, on paper. So it is the paper issue that brings this affidavit of the credit provider to the fore. So we need to keep those balancing in right, because you need to listen to both sides of the case. The National Credit Tribunal, our consumer tribunal, can then say, no, I disagree with the regulator. This person does not qualify for debt relief, and they can reject. Because that is it's a judicial entity and must be able to reject. Or they can say, no, we also view that this is a better candidate for debt review and can refer. There was a proposal from Ms. McPherson, in fact, about subsidizing debt review fees. And I've spoken yesterday with the National Credit Regulator about that. Apparently there was some provision at a point in time. And they will just find out for us how it worked, whether it was a line item in DTI's budget, whether it was, you know, where the money came from. But she said it was stopped because there wasn't really an uptake for it. But if it was a line item, it is perhaps something that can be looked at again to then subsidize that way. And then it is something we can put it in the bill, but if it is something that can happen automatically through the budget process, then we don't even have to provide for it in this bill. It is something that can be done. If they refer it for debt review, then that fund can kick in. Like I said yesterday, if it is, however, a fund that is envisaged where credit provides, because that was also mooted during all the stakeholder consultations, a fund where credit providers will pay a certain levy per month, then we need to be careful that we, if it can be seen as a tax, it will be a bill that must be introduced by the Minister of Finance. And if we create a fund that keeps money from the fiscus, the Minister of Finance will have to give permission. If it is not a tax, and we can include it in legislation from the DTI side, then we'll still need permission from the Minister of Finance. So those are just some things to think about, but the regulator will maybe give us a little bit more input on that line item or fund, whatever it was, what the exact nature was, where the money came from, so that can be considered. Now, the tribunal can also, if the referral from the National Credit Regulator indicated that there was a reckless transaction or unlawful agreement, then declare that void. If there is an existing restructuring agreement, but there was certain things not happening, they can order specific performance, or they can give once off debt relief or a combination of these orders. In other words, they can split the debt up for things to happen differently. Yeah. Now, once off debt relief orders, there are three big possibilities and in its conditions, and I've provided for it at the discretion. The NINA programs from New Zealand, UK and Wales have a specific order in which orders are given. So it is suspended for 12 months. After 12 months there is a review, then the following can happen. I have not drafted it like that, but the committee can decide that it must be in those steps. The reason I did not draft it like that is because people's circumstances differ. So it might be for one person, the tribunal says, but I can see that you can repay something right now. If I cap your interest, you can repay. For another person, but you know, I have an interview planned in the next week and it looks very promising, perhaps that person it could be suspended. A third person might be in such dire circumstances, maybe just had a car accident and is totally immobilized and definitely can't find a job very, very soon. Maybe the house has just burned down. You know, very, very dire circumstances. Mm-hmm. What would it help to suspend for 12 months? It's clear that there is insufficient prospect. I do not think that that will be the first option in many of the cases. But I have made that at the discretion available to the tribunal. We, of course, will have to apply their margin of facts before them, and then make a specific order. The other thing is that there can be conditions. And those conditions, I've made them quite broad, but the two that might be of interest and might even be contentious to some extent is to limit the consumer's right to apply for credit and the attendance of a financial literacy or budgeting skills program. There was also a proposal that this must be mandatory. That can be done if the committee feels that it must. But again, I was of the view that any person's circumstances might be different as they appear before the tribunal. It might be someone that was retrenched but had a very good credit record, clearly could budget, clearly knew what was going on, and it was simply this retrenchment that interfered. Perhaps it's not necessary to send that person to attend training. But like I say, those are the kind of things that we can talk about, whether they should be mandatory, whether we want the discretion, whether we want the progression of orders standing. The next slide just kind of gives an indication of the right to apply for credit. Now, the time periods here are absolutely 100% still open for discussion. I simply try to do a progressive sliding scale kind of between 1.5 years to 5 years, depending on the severity of the order. So that is kind of what that tries to explain. So if it was only a repayment order, you might be looking at a maximum of 18 months where the person will be taken out of the credit market. But if it was extinguished, you're looking at a maximum of 60 months. And again, I've made this discretionary so that the tribunal can make it 1 month or 0 months or 60 months, depending on the circumstances. But like I say, this is something for the committee to discuss. This is just an option I've think it, for me, it was kind of a compromise between the views that I've heard on the latter proposal. The next slide, because of this limitation and removing the consumer for a little bit, just to give them that space to rehabilitate from the credit market, we will need to have the credit bureaus involved. But then once that period is over, we need to make provision for the bureaus to remove the information so that it does not prejudice the consumer after that period is served. So it should not be something where the consumer has to apply or, you know, because you're not going to have a credit provider involved here. It's going to be a court order. So I've made provision for automatic removal after a certain period. Again, those dates can be looked at, but mainly I've said 7 days after the period has expired. So within a week, if you were out of the credit market for 2 years, 2 years expired, within 7 days, credit bureau must remove that information from your record automatically. What would be the effect? Once the application is in, immediately the consumer may no longer incur any other charges under a credit facility or enter into any other further credit agreement. In other words, you've now applied, you need to stop. You need to show that you are serious about this application. But also the credit providers can't now, while the debt relief application is being considered, come and institute legal proceedings against you. So on both sides, we say, just halt for a moment. Once it is granted, the consumer, again, may not incur any further charges under a credit facility or enter into any further credit agreement for whatever the period is that is applicable. And I want to just pause here, and again, you will remember that I said developmental credit agreements, public interest credit. Those are slightly different issues because record lending principles do not apply to these. So the proposal that I've made is that this kind of credit agreement should not be extinguished. An order for extinguishing of debt should not apply to these, simply because already the credit provider is requested to take a bigger risk and we want them to continue to give this kind of loan. So this is kind of the protection that it will not be extinguished, it will be repaid. But again, it is for the committee to decide whether that is the case. Perhaps this is also something where the trade or the regulator can perhaps come and just discuss with the committee what is envisaged with these developmental credit public interest. So the committee can get their heads around this, see how it will be affected by this measure, and then take an informed decision on should they be excluded, etc. Because also what happens in the bill is that while the person is taken out of the credit market, these two loans will still be applicable and they can still apply for them. So that is also something to consider. Do we want that? Do we not want that? The other thing that we also need to keep in mind, and I know I've neglected to say this, but the limit on a person's participation in the credit market, the limit on applying for credit, could also be not a blanket restriction. We can say that for a period of, you know, the periods that I've set out, so let's say for the 5 years, you can only apply for credit up to a maximum of R5,000. So we can put a number there, which will then allow the person at least to maybe qualify for something. So that is also a possibility. There is a precedent for that. New Zealand's MENA program has a prescribed limit that they can apply for. I would not suggest that we make that prescribed because our measure is once off. So we're going to have an idea where this measure is going already once this bill is out, but it can be something that is prescribed. I'm just worried about the delay. I've also said yesterday some of the things like the information that has to be supplied, all of those things can be prescribed by the minister. But then we will, as the committee will have to make sure that from an oversight perspective, those regulations are ready when this act is promulgated. Otherwise, we are going to halt the whole process waiting for those regulations to come into play. The credit provider, the consequences for a credit provider, if the agreement was declared reckless or unlawful, or if the debt was extinguished, then the rights of the credit provider under that agreement stop, and they cannot enforce any further. So I think that kind of speaks for itself, but following the line of the principal act and how things are worded, I've just included that as well. Now, what?
Sorry, advocate. What page of the framework bill is it? That one on the debt relief granted, you know, the second one, the extinguished one. And that's after the development loan, but.
The orders by the tribunal is on page 17. It is subsection 4 there.
Okay.
And the extinguishment itself is paragraph C, so at the bottom of page 17. And then if you turn over to page 18, paragraph D there, subparagraph 2, speaks about the limitation on the consumer's rights. And then paragraph, subsection 6 at the bottom of page 18. That's where I'm giving some periods.
Okay.
So, and you will see those periods are in purple, which means I will need to definitely discuss things still.
Okay.
Then, what happens? What happens if the consumer circumstances change, whether for good or for bad? The consumer is required to inform the regulator of those changed circumstances, and that may lead to an amendment of the order. Circumstances have gotten worse, so instead of suspending, we can now say, no, the debt must be extinguished. It's clear for the next 12 months nothing's going to happen. Why wait? Or there was maybe a repayment, and now we see now it needs to be suspended. Or the person has just landed a very nice job, earning now 10 or 15,000 rand, and can actually start repaying. So the suspension can perhaps be lifted and certain repayments made. But if the consumer's financial circumstances change and the person did not inform the tribunal of that, or the person failed to comply with any restrictions, then other than non-compliant, or the consumer was dishonest and it turns out that there was more income or more debt or anything like that, then the tribunal can actually rescind the debt relief that was given. So it will put the consumer back in the position where that consumer started a little bit worse off because there will now be interest, etc., that applies. The question yesterday that we did look at is whether this should be an offence for the consumer not to comply, not to inform. I think that is something that the committee will have to look at. The feeling seems to be that there must be some kind of penalty because it is serious. We want them to comply, and we need to maybe just look at that. Mr. McPherson also, in his written input, proposed an aftercare mechanism to monitor these consumers. And, I got from the members yesterday that definitely these consumers have to be monitored. We need to know what's going on. We need to know where they are and what's happening to them financially. But I have proposed that yesterday that the National Credit Regulator perhaps should brief the committee on whether there is an existing mechanism like that. And if not, what would they propose? And then, if necessary, we can add that to the bill. The second measure is prescribing. And there are very strict criteria for what the minister can prescribe. The measures kind of copy what is in the once-off. Capping interest charges on page 19 of the slide. And in the bill, on page 23 of the bill. So I've kind of copied what the once-off debt relief measure does, the capping of interest, suspension, extinguishing of debt, but I've also provided for the minister to prescribe the liquidation process for consumers with minimal income and assets. In other words, copying MENA, but something that will not have a cut-off date on debt, something where consumers who do not qualify for sequestration, who need to be able to get some relief, can actually apply, and there is this informal sequestration process available to them. Clear criteria of who the beneficiaries must be, indigent, childless household, or if there was retrenchment in a sector or disasters in a sector or a region. And only if there was a significant exogenous shock, an external shock that caused this, or a regional natural disaster. An inspected liquidation process for consumers who don't qualify for sequestration if there's no efficient or effective method to relieve that household. This criteria becomes very, very important when we look at the next slide of process. Because if the minister
want to go broader, and the minister actually has to get the permission of the House. Then after the Parliament is very clear in asserting what can happen in these regulations, the minister is not given too broad a discretion. This is what you must do. If you want to go broad, you first must get our permission. But the minister must also consult the National Assembly if he doesn't want to go broader, he or she. They must consult ministers responsible for finance and justice, the regulator, and the tribunal, as well as the credit industry. And this consultation is not just going to be lying there and can be swept under the carpet. Because once it, the minister must publish in the government gazette the whole set of what will happen, and then give 30 days to comment. We can look at the 30 days. Should it be longer, shorter? But we need to be careful about shorter, but longer, if there is a natural disaster, you might run into trouble there because then it becomes too long a period. But then the minister must consider the comment and file a report or table a report in Parliament to comment, to say what happened with those comments. In other words, I'm not going to accept it because of this and the following. So to make sure Parliament can be absolutely sure that these things have been looked at. Then I'm not going to go too much in detail to consequential amendments. Mainly it is about making sure that the Act actually provides for debt relief, what it applies to, who it does not apply to, extending the functions of the credit bureaus, of the National Credit Regulator, so it's clear that those things are there. What I am, a big change perhaps, is to allow courts to take judicial notice of over-indebtedness, and empowering the tribunal to declare a credit agreement unlawful, and providing for the interaction between the tribunal and a court if a matter comes before a court, and just changing the long title to make sure that everything is right. Then there was a view that because indubitably is not provided for in the Act, that we must provide for it in the Bill. But I have to look to work through the whole Act in order to make sure that the Bill is aligned with the Act and that it fits in snugly and does not disrupt the proceedings. And I found in Section 103, Subsection 5, the exact section that we were asked to draft. So I did not include it in the Bill. What we can do is trace and indicate to us what is the problem with this, but because it is in the Act, I think this now forms part of the review process that trade is busy with, and the leniency that the committee was doing in adding this to a debt relief measure bill actually falls away because it is in the Act. The rationale was that there is no provision for it, but clearly there is. Then just lastly, the way forward. Consultation. Like I said, I discussed with the tribunal and said they don't think it's necessary, but the Superior Courts Act does require that the Minister of Justice be consulted if the structural functions of the court or tribunal are amended. I'm thinking about it, and I'm not sure that the functions are amended, but I don't think it can hurt to consult with the Minister in anything. I'm also allowing for other orders to be made by magistrates' courts. So it might be good to just have that consultation. It means that they are aware of it in any event.
Yeah.
Then, like I said, further input from the regulator and the tribunal, especially on the processes that are proposed. It might be very impractical what I'm proposing, but they need to tell us that it can't work and how it should rather work. Of course, then deliberations. And then lastly, I've just mentioned that, you know, this bill is supposed to run parallel with another process, the review of the Coffee Act. And we need to make sure that review does not affect this bill or this bill, that review, and if necessary, the bill needs to be amended to tie in with that review. So that must just not be forgotten. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bridget van der Merwe, for that succinct briefing. It really is helpful. Members, just before I proceed on that issue, I didn't want to recognize everyone in the first as I came in because we were short of time to take certain decisions. But we should note that, for example, the DTI is here with the acting DDG, Mr. Nyetse Tenzi of the Consumer Corporate Regulation Division, Same Division. Again, we have Mr. Sipa Mangla, Director there, Debt Relief, and also Mr. Makotsi, yeah, right, Debt Relief as well in that section. And then the National Treasury, you know, it must have always, I see you've kind of got your roller skates in your briefcase these days, you know, at a moment's notice, Treasury does come short notice, and we do appreciate that, Ms. Gibson. Thank you very much. And she's the senior advisor, Market Conduct there. I'm not sure of Mr. Habermann's exact position there, but he's also from National Treasury, right? And then we have, I think that's National Treasury then, and the DTI, as I have it. And then, am I correct? Yes. And then we have the National Credit Regulator, again, the CEO, Ms. Nomsa Machigari, who's become almost a kind of, you know, co-opted into the committee in terms of her attendance. And then Mr. Mashapa, thank you very much for also attending so regularly, and so that you're fully briefed on issues. Now, members, some of you, in fact, most of you here now, are those who were not here yesterday for very valid reasons. So you need to be aware, yes, we did get this briefing, and I said, look, we'll have some clarifications, etc., but we need an in-depth discussion, which is why we extended the Thursday, of course. But at this moment in time, you have the work of Advocate van der Merwe, which we instructed her to move ahead with, and what she's done, as she puts it very clearly, is to look at all of the deliberations of the committee since this came to the fore, as well as when it was tabled in Parliament, and Parliament agreed that we would go ahead and develop this bill. And then she was working with this, and frankly not many members actually sent in anything extra over and above that. However, the Honourable MacPherson did email us, and because he was overseas in Geneva, I imagine, at the time, and request if we could just extend this a couple of days. As I said to him myself now, we couldn't say to the advocate, throw out the window everything you've done and start again. We said, no, look, you're 90% of the way. However, where the points made by the Honourable MacPherson are not already there, they're just noted. And I think I must make that clear. So now's not the time for any one of us to go in depth on these points, but rather tomorrow. But use this opportunity to seek clarification here and there so we are prepared for the in-depth discussion tomorrow. Is that okay with everyone here? Fine. Okay. So, on that note then, I'm going to recognize members who should feel free then to get a clarification and to make a comment where feasible. Noting, of course, that this committee will be deadline for this, our committee is probably 10:30. Is it all 10? 10:30. Right, do go ahead. And who's standing at the doorway? Are you the new doorkeeper? What's going on there?
Bigger pod, I think.
No, you're welcome to take a seat.
No, okay. I think this is the meeting I'm waiting for started later.
Oh, the finance.
But the finance meeting.
Ah, oh, right. Well, you're welcome to sit down here and learn something, yes. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Williams, yes. Honourable Yesterhazer. Right. Honourable Pinguini, thank you. In that order, please.
Thank you very much. I'll keep my comments brief because, as I said, it's my chairperson. I'll be presenting or speaking more to my documents tomorrow. But I just understand that I'm glad that Ms. Gibson is here because one of the key things I've been saying throughout this entire time is that any review needs to be based on evidence. On information that we receive from Treasury and from the industry. And that's why we put together a terms of reference for study to be done. And I would just like to know from Ms. Gibson where we are in that process of getting that information back. Because, you know, I'm really getting concerned that we're getting so far down this process or this track, and we don't have that information, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to base my judgment and submissions without that information. I'm trying to do my best to put these arguments together, but unless I have that, I'm making guesses the whole time. And that's a very, very dangerous space for a legislator to be in, to be making information on guesses and feelings and not facts and figures. So I really do ask that we get some response to that. Advocate, with your presentation that you've just given, and I do apologize that I wasn't here, so I may ask a question that has already been responded to, but I'm just concerned that this process is not being seen as an entire review of the MCA, which I think we've all agreed should be the process to handle this bill in. And your last point that you made on the way forward seems to me or suggests that you still see this as sort of a two-pronged focus, one on debt relief through the bill that's before us, and then again another review of the MCA. And I'm concerned that we're going to be duplicating something that I think that we should and can be doing in one process, because you will recall from the document that I submitted to you that I make mention of how do we review the NCR's powers with respect to rent spending, and actually the big elephant in the room is how do we deal with the NCT, because I'm not sure that the NCT should continue to be a quasi-judicial organization, and they will, and I have no doubt that they will continue to argue that they should be. But they are the biggest stumbling block to debt relief and debt review in this country because of the extraordinary time that they take, the barrier that they are to justice for consumers that are wanting to seek relief. So I think that we can have all the good intentions in the world of dealing with this bill, advocate, but until we merge the two processes together and not deal with it as two streams, I'm concerned that we're not going to achieve entirely what we're looking to do.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Williams.
Thanks, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've still got this a concern about the clause that talks about the affidavit from the credit provider to make an objection to the debt relief measures. My concern is that the credit provider could hire a company to object to all of the applications and therefore just bring the whole process to an end. And I'd like to know why we want to include this, or could we include it if the debt is to the highest, the maximum amount? Like, for instance, let's say we go for the maximum amount of 30,000 Rand. Then if you're applying for that to be removed, then the credit provider could have the opportunity to object to that. But if it's an amount of 5,000 Rand, perhaps we shouldn't allow that. I'm very concerned about this. I do think that if we leave this in place without seriously looking at it, we could in fact end up with a situation where every single application for debt relief will be objected to by the credit providers and slow the whole process down. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. Honourable Esther Hazen.
Thank you, Chair. I unfortunately had a bit from Maribel. I also was not here in the previous for other reasons. But my concern, as the chairperson pointed out, the National Credit Act already made provision to lenders to approach banks and restructure their credit, and that exists. I've got also a very big concern with the word debt for forgiveness. If lenders are controlled by legislation to write off even a very small amount of debt, this would really shake the confidence of the whole of the South African economy to the core as well. That's one of the issues. Other problem is the NCR, the National Credit Regulator, has the power to increase the minimum expense threshold that the credit providers use. I think it's at 9% of this. Why can't this be increased? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Ian Terhaven, Honourable King Weenie.
Thanks, Chair. My chair is basically on the dates and on the time frames and stuff and so forth that was mentioned. And I think you have said we are going in on
is
it tomorrow. It's on. And I think you said we're going to go more into it tomorrow.
Indeed.
So I think I'll hold off on those type of questions and things that I wanted to raise regarding time frames and so forth. But I think the advocate made a submission that we need to consult the Minister of Justice as well. And I think I want to propose that support that proposal as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't have cause and in essence don't consult with the Minister of Justice, because it will just be another bill that will pass and then tomorrow a person will say no, but we were not aware that this function comes to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to and iron out whichever departments that are coming forth within the bill that we need to consult with and make aware that this is our proposal and so forth, that these functions don't just come unannounced to the department. Thank you.
No, thank you, Honourable Pinguini. Right. That's members there. I don't think I asked this yesterday. It was the issue around the child-headed household. I just want you to confirm that my understanding there is not that child-headed, a child under 18, as it were, I think that's the law, should be getting into debt, but that inadvertently they find themselves in this situation because they are running this household and you've got, municipal fees and the like coming to that house, if you like. And I just want that clarified, though, because it's a little bit of an anomaly. You see, that a child is getting into debt. I'm not sure of the legal issues around that particular one. The other point as well is I don't want us to create any more breaks. Already we've got too many impediments here. And this issue of, did you say the credit tribunal at some point on one of the slides, you know, would be able to take this and decide when and how, etc. I hope that doesn't mean that they're going to have a box full of these things and not be able to get through them in time. So I want to support the point made by the Honourable Williams that we take that issue very, very seriously. The other one was, you mentioned towards the end about the Nduplum, and that somewhere or other there was a view that this was not catered or covered in the bill. But that it is, and you refer to the section specifically, and are you actually proposing that we leave this out or make reference to it in our bill indicating it will be addressed in the review? I don't know. Perhaps you could be clearer on that. I would like to leave it out and then find when the department brings us their bill, it's still not there, because then you're going to take another 3 years, as it were, you see. So let's get very clear on that kind of thing. I'd like to for you to tell us, Advocate van der Merwe, because I couldn't seem to find this very clear anywhere, with the bill addressing the admin costs here. Who's going to be bearing these admin costs, broadly speaking? Because often the admin costs are what puts up the fees in this direction. And then I'll make some final comments after those have been responded to.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I think Treasury can answer after me around the research. I can actually answer everything. The issue of the entire review of the Credit Act versus the measure. The, as I understand my instructions, the bill of the committee will only focus on a debt relief measure, and it is in fact separate from the greater review application. And part of the reason for that is that, especially some of the things that, that you've mentioned, the tribunal, for instance, and what their power should be and how they work and what they should look like, those are not things that can be resolved in the next month. And the need for the debt relief bill to go out, as I understand it, is quite urgent. And it's in fact, exactly because of that, that because the review was going to take more than the time that the committee was satisfied with, that the committee decided to take a part of that review, which is the debt relief measure, and took that out of the review of the National Credit Act, and said this will form a committee bill. So that is how I understand my instructions. If that is not the instructions, then I need clarity on that. But I understand the instruction as that it is in fact there's a National Credit Act review process underway, and the committee bill is taking a part of that review and putting that into a committee bill.
Right.
Mr. Williams, then the problem with the affidavit of the credit provider is that we need to apply the legal principle of allowing both sides to be heard. And the reason I have inserted the affidavit is to avoid the credit provider coming to the tribunal when the hearing is done and actually starting to talk and call witnesses. So the idea is to say to the credit provider, you can have a say, you can have your say, but then as I've mentioned yesterday, I've made a note to limit the time in which that affidavit can be given, so it's not open-ended. That was in fact an oversight. I agree the idea was for it to be part of the application process. So to limit that time in which that affidavit can be given, that is where the credit provider makes his or her input. The objection to the application, I'm afraid it's neither here nor there if the consumer actually qualifies. Because it is a tick box. Do you earn less than this? Is this your debt? Is this the, you know, so if that qualifies, there's very little that the credit provider can say to make the person not qualify. So this is really just to allow both sides to be heard, and then, like I say, to avoid it turning into a trial at the time of the tribunal actually hearing this. So that was the reason for that. Perhaps there could be other people who can give us another option. This is from what my brain could provide. But I'm sure that there's a lot of brains around this table. Someone might be able to say, but why do we do it this way? This is maybe another way for the credit providers to be heard, or this is maybe a way to make sure that they don't take over the process. In respect of, well, debt forgiveness, Mr. Isaacson, we've already in the first slide, I've indicated that when it comes to, debt terminology, I could be instructed differently from the committee side, it is your will, but I've chosen to use the word debt relief rather than forgiveness, because although the terminology seems to be interchangeable in a number of documents that I've come across, the majority of documents use forgiveness when it comes to extinguishing. The concern that you raise in respect of whether extinguishing should be part of the debt relief measure is something that the committee will have to instruct me on, because my instructions, as I understand, from the subcommittee and from the bigger committee itself, and also looking at the other measures like the NINA, because there is an extinguishing of debt if after a period of time they see that nothing can happen, because it's very similar to sequestration, except that there is not necessarily benefit for creditors. And in a sequestration process, there is writing off of certain debt. It's maybe not the right word, if it's being used in a different sense, but in practice, the credit provided is writing off a certain amount of that debt. But like I say, I'm not the one to talk policy. My instruction is that extinguishing must be part of the debt relief measure. So already what I've tried to do is to soften that effect by making it one of the discretionary orders that the tribunal will be giving. In respect of
looking at existing measures. Again, it is part of the instruction from the committee to say that the existing measures are not sufficient and there must be the centralised measures. So unless the committee changes that instruction, that is what I'm active on. From Mrs. Lenguini, I think that was my comment. We'll have more tomorrow. Mrs. Fox, in respect of childhood households, exactly. It is absolutely those inadvertent debts that land on their shoulders. It is one of the reasons I've included incidental credit agreements, because an incidental credit agreement is not something that from the start is a credit agreement. It is a purchase agreement. You will come and clean the carpet for me. And the child is late in paying, and because interest is charged, it becomes the incidental credit agreement. So that is why I've included that. I'm not sure that incidental credit agreement should be included, but we'll need some input from the regulator, CTI, on what their views are on that. But also, targeted households, we must keep in mind that it is quite likely that a number of the credit agreements that form part of their application will be reckless or unlawful. And those will then, of course, be excluded. So it gives a little bit of a leeway. It adds a little bit to give them that opportunity to come and do that. Using the credit card the consumer tribunal, I cannot speak for the tribunal, if I can put it like that. I've tried my best to put processes in this bill that makes the requirement for what they can do to simplify as much as possible. So I've provided for a single tribunal member to be able to consider an application, so they don't need a full bench. It can be a single person, and it can be on paper. In other words, it's only if there's a dispute that they might want to call a witness. But otherwise, they will look at the application, tick the boxes. Yes, the boxes are ticked. Or if there's an affidavit from the credit provider, what does the credit provider say? How will this impact? And that is what I consider. That application, most of them should be able to be considered in half an hour max. So the tribunal member could probably even sit in his or her office and go through these applications on paper. So that is what I've done to try and make it a faster, speedier process. Whether that will work, the tribunal will have to come in and say to this committee, yes, it will or will not. And that is also what I've said to say, I'm using the words regulator and tribunal because those are the existing bodies. The committee might find that they do not have the necessary capacity and that we want to move this to something else. But then that is where we will have to discuss and see where it is moved. I use the tribunal rather than a court because I thought that this committee at least had a little bit more oversight capacity over the tribunal than over court. So that is why I didn't go the court route, I rather went the tribunal route. So I do acknowledge that it might be a problem, but we need another body to consider the application from the body that evaluated it. So we need two bodies involved. Especially because that order that is given affects constitutional rights. So we need a type of judicial body that can consider that, and a tribunal is then appropriate. In respect of In Duplum, the reason for In Duplum to be included was that if the Act does not make provision, that is what we were informed. But Section 103, Subsection 5, if I look at it, I started drafting a clause for this, and then when I looked at 103.5, I thought, but this is what my clause says. I did not go broader than 103.5. So in my view, 103.5 covers it. It makes provision. If there's an implementation problem, it becomes oversight. If there is something missing, then the committee can decide if the committee wants to instruct. I was just a bit careful of that because, first of all, I don't know what the problem is. For me, it reads very clear and all of those costs are out. But the reason
why we did not address recklessness, recklessly the powers of the NCR was because those are already covered in the Act and they should be part of the review process. So that is just why I'm saying,
sure.
If it is in the Act and there's something wrong with it, maybe it should rather be part of the review process. But like I said, it's for this committee to instruct and say we want different amendments. Administration costs, I have in fact not provided for the regulator to charge any administration fees for this. And the regulator needs to maybe advise us if there's a different method for them to get these costs, because the idea is there should not be costs involved in this. So even the reporting to the credit bureaus, I've made the specific provision that the credit bureaus can't charge the regulator for receiving that information. So it's a very good question. It's something that the regulator must maybe just confirm for us that there isn't another way for them to get administration costs, because then we need to amend that and make very clear that in respect of this decorative application, there is no administrative cost.
I saw sorry, Honourable Kacharya. Anyone else down there? No? Honourable Wynne, Honourable McPherson.
Thank you. It's occurred to me that insofar as we refer to prescribing debt relief measures and talk about forgiveness, to build on what Honourable Essayman said, I'm also concerned about the use of those terms, and I would prefer and ask the committee to consider the use of something like debt responsibility intervention as opposed to relief or forgiveness.
Thank you, Honourable Kachania. Honourable
Williams. I just got a question around that affidavit again. I just want to know, what do other countries that have debt relief measures do with regard to that principle of getting the other side's opinion? Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable McPherson, other than the question that Ms. Gibson
Thank you, Advocate. The one thing that I'm still concerned about is there seems to be very little discussion or mention about legal credit and how we're going to deal with legal credit. Because what we're doing here is, you know, we're focusing solely on credit that people have applied and received through a affordability assessment. So I would turn that as legal credit, and they have the options of debt review to rearrange that. Then you have reckless credit, which is in fact legal and can be extinguished on the spot if it is so to speak, if it's deemed reckless. But we have no way or we have no manner to deal with illegal credit. Now I think that where a big focus of this should be is people who have fallen into the debt trap in places very much like Rustenburg. Miners and mining families that have, a few thousand rand provided to them, they have their ID books taken away. We don't want to seem to deal with that, and that for me is really concerning. Because, and I would love to have the statistics around this, but I don't, so I'm thinking hypothetically. But I think that that's where people are really struggling, to be honest. That's where families are getting hammered by people that have given them money that they should never have gotten in the first place. And we don't seem to want to talk to that, and I'd just like to understand why. I really want to push back quite hard on this idea of one person in the tribunal dealing with these applications. The first problem is you're going to have thousands of applications. So you're just going to bog that process up, and you're going to create this backlog like very few people have seen before. And the second thing is, I'm not sure it's within the interest of justice to give one sole person the ability to decide whether someone should get their debt extinguished. I don't think that that's acceptable, and I think we really need to refrain from that. I think that we can't have one person having that much power. that there shouldn't be costs, but the bottom line is, advocate, there's always going to be costs. And, you know, I'm not sure that the credit bureaus, unless you've had a discussion with them, and for the record, I haven't, but I'm not sure that they're going to, you know, just say, yeah, sure, no problem, we're happy to deal with this, we're going to do it pro bono. I don't, I mean, they're businesses. So I think that we need to think about that. And then one of your points that you made in your presentation, that if someone is going through debt review, and maybe I've misunderstood it, you can correct me, I've had to speak to you, so, or they are sort of on a probation period, they should still be able to reapply for a limited amount of credit, say, and you mentioned an amount like 5,000 rand. I think that completely defeats the point of wanting to rehabilitate people into good credit consumers. I mean, they've gotten themselves into a problem because they either have, you know, through no fault of their own, they've lost their job, or they've taken on too much credit. And now we want to assist them, and at the same time we say, but here, have some more, you know, goals and get some more credit. I'm not sure that that's responsible, and I think I would really encourage us to relook at that. Because I think at the end of the day, advocate, and I know it's something that you and I both agree on, is that what we want is we want to ensure that we maintain the stability of the credit market. Because South Africans, by and large, can't live without access to credit. And what we don't want to see is and I made it in my submission, is that credit is restricted to consumers. And the second thing that we don't want is we don't want credit to become more expensive, because that's what I think on the extreme right-hand side of all of this could lead to, is a restriction and drying up of access to credit, and the cost of accessing credit increase, and then in fact we actually put people straight back into their situation again, where they can't afford the credit because it's jumped up, because, you know, credit providers have to make up for your losses and account for these costs somewhere.
Thank you. Honourable
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to comment on what Honourable Williams said. But I was going to say I agree with Honourable Pearson was saying, 100%. South Africans own something like 1.6 trillion rand, and why has it ever got to that? It really, we mustn't forget Sovereigns and the African Bank and things like that. Just on other countries, if you look at the debt-to-income ratio, South Africa is at 74%, which doesn't sound too bad, comparing to the UK, for one, was 145%. But the UK is based on cement and stone and things. That's all, and at a 2% interest rate. South Africa is definitely far from that. This is for the poorest of the poor has been taken advantage of in this country. And so many job opportunities have actually now been created for debt counselors and things that take advantage of the people who haven't really got money.
Fine. Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Yester. Allow me to get Ms. Simpson to respond first to the Honourable MacPherson's question that was previously asked, and then yourself as Bishop Van der Merwe.
Thank you, Chair. In responding to the question on the data, it's a slightly wider response. I'm taking a little bit of liberty in there.
Yes.
Okay, so I think the question of this today is an important one. And, on the one hand, it's very useful to be seeing the bill and exactly what's being expected and anticipated, because then you can start putting a concrete framework to consider what the impact is and what it's like. But I echo your thoughts that it's something which, while it's useful to see so we can start planning and improving, at the same time, it's not a project we want to finalise without getting that research and having a much better assessment of impact. And the impact here is not just on the who's going to be affected. In other words, is it retailers and banks? It also looks at other things like what is affordable actually for consumers. And that's very important in terms of shaping the options going forward. So for example, and one of the important references is the affordability criteria. But actually affordability criteria currently for this group might actually be significant. It might be too high, in which case we need to consider those systems. So the research was to answer your question under we started going on the data. We're getting access to the data, I think we had been talking about getting that to you in November, so there's still some time running. Which we had made, we've been making very clear. So really, as I said, we wouldn't like it. Are you going to give us an opportunity to speak more widely later?
In response to the question, bearing in mind that I don't know if you're going to be here. You see, so because of that, it would be important that you respond as much as you can.
Should have put that on, gosh, the woman line.
Yes, as you're not going to be here tomorrow, please use this opportunity.
Thank you very much. So I think one of the questions which has been coming up on this extinguishing of some of the other direct decrease measures is an important issue as well. It also raises questions around what is the scope or purpose of this law versus the general review process. I think that there's also a question around the question mark around the scope of these debt relief measures, the extent to which they are actually in line with the Credit Act. And I'm talking here specifically around the once-off measures. So if I can distinguish between the once-off measures and the minister powers, and whether it is actually appropriate to be done through an amendment to the Credit Act versus whether in fact it should actually be a standalone act, depending on given the respective intentions and purposes of this legislation. I think one of the other main issues, and this goes to the inducement rule, relates to what we haven't spoken about here, and which are critical to this process, are the debt collectors. So we're talking about credit providers, but actually one of the biggest problems that we're seeing is way past the credit providers, and it's actually sitting with the debt collectors.
Yes.
And that's where the inducement problem comes in, is that the question is, when does inducement apply? And if you look at the full cycle of the debt collection process, right from the initial origination through to the collection by the credit provider, and then there may be a whole lot of stuff that happens after that. There's been question around whether, and to be blunt, whether the legal fees, because they're claimed as legal fees, collected by attorneys in debt collection actually are subject to that. And their interpretation obviously has been that they're not. The clarification, there has been declaratory orders made in terms of the law, in terms of the court by the courts, but I think, the credit regulators and the DTR are probably better placed to talk about this. I think more clarity is definitely needed to firm that up. The issue on debt collectors then is an interesting one, and this also then goes to the question around jurisdiction, and in terms of the Credit Act, actually would have fit there. And we've been having some discussions around whether the 20 people actually give the provision to get to debt collectors.
Sure.
But it might be something that you want to consider directly in terms of the legislation. I'm not sure on the jurisdiction. I think then probably my two final points is that I appreciate the effort that's been gone in. Okay, maybe I can separate out my comments on the one-off relief.
Yeah.
On the one-off relief, I appreciate the clarity that's been given. It's very clear who's intended to qualify and the process that's expected to qualify. That will make it much easier to assess. which is good. I think that, because I know that I've heard that there's the intention to streamline that process, my sense is that it needs to be streamlined considerably more. Mm-hmm. And the streamlining, I think, to differentiate is not by cutting out the checks and balances.
Right.
It's by maybe seeing where we can cut down discretion. Because the moment you've got discretion, you're placing a burden.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, where we talk about you may have a cap, or you may restrict credits after 3 months. Actually, no, you should restrict, you must make them up. You can't take credits for 6 months.
Yeah.
Or, where's the process about, well, let's see after 6 months, or maybe 12 months, that you could actually prescribe. Given this, initially we don't extinguish, you've got 6 months, you come back after 6 months, we check. If you, then we give you another 6 months, after 18 or whatever the period is, then we extinguish. Like, make it very clear that you really, whoever is doing the assessment, can actually just go and do the assessment. In terms of the questions around the right to the creditor to respond, the lender to respond, I think that's important. The main issue I see here, though, is one around whether the person is actually honest about their income. And so again, I think we can maybe think creatively around how can we check whether people are being honest about their income. So for example, and there might be privacy issues here, but if you want to qualify, the bank can basically check if this person linked to this ID number has bank accounts and if they actually have income or not. And that's a standard process that could be built in. Again, I'm just putting this as a question mark. Because there obviously is an incentive for people to be underplaying what their income is. So that's broadly on the 1/4. I think we would have, we've got much greater concerns at this stage. I don't mean qualify that to say. I think we still have, we're still uneasy about this notion of extinguishing debt, but I think we can take steps to mitigate the risk. We've got much, at this stage, much graver concerns around the, what we see as actually extensive powers being given to the Minister of Trade and Industry, where actually those categories are not defined and the process is not as clearly spelled out. We can't actually see what the impact is. And I think that requires much broader consideration, much more consideration. Yes, I just lost to say that we do support the idea of monitoring on a few over time. I think it's important what we haven't yet been able to accurately track is the extent to which persons who have been given some relief, whatever that relief is, whether they are sustainably rehabilitated. And that's obviously critical. And I think in doing so, if we are thinking about doing additional categories in future, we very much need to make sure that what we're doing now is actually working. And then I think lastly, just as a final point, I think it would be, in addition to some of the considerations here around what needs to be considered, and this is now on the for the one source relief that has been captured, I think that we just need to give thought around how do you capture other principles that, so for example, broader economic effects or financial stability effects, I don't know, it's a question mark.
Right.
So thank you very much.
Yeah, I know you can't be here again this week, we realise that, but I really need you to share with us your availability next week. We can adjust our programme accordingly, and I'm not going to ask you to tell us this minute, but to liaise with Mr. Herman on the matter. Is that all right with you?
That is all right. And just one more thing is that I think when we're talking about the minister powers, it goes to the question around the board and the review process, is that I think it is a priority that reform happens and that the debt relief, we can consider it relief in the wider sense, is actually given or worked out for people above 3,500. But that should ideally happen through the existing processes. And then it's a question of how can those
Right. Now, thank you, Ms. Gibson. As I indicated, I'd appreciate it. We all would that there would be this liaison with Mr. Herman. And thank you for, making yourself available to us today.
I'd like to ask Advocate Van der Merwe to refrain from making her responses now. We need to get, you know, close the meeting, adjourn at 10:30 exactly, as this room needs to be cleaned out, as it were, so that finance, the joint committee with finance and trade and industry, can begin sharp at 11. So I apologize to those of you who raised these questions in other areas, but I also want to thank you for your commitment and application to the debt, what is known as we sit here now as the debt relief bill, per se. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned until tomorrow, Thursday, Honourable Esther Hayton. Honourable Esther Hayton, I'm sorry I haven't got some music to announce what I'm saying, but at 9 a.m. Thursday,